The clerk will call the docket.
Winsett Construction and Water Corporation versus General Land Commercial Real Estate Corporation. This is part of the construction capital, in the phase one of the estimated capital.
You may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Joseph Pope, and I'm here on behalf of Raztec Construction. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. A time is of the essence provision is a tool, contract administration, and enforcement. These provisions are commonly found in commercial contracts, and they provide certainty and objectivity in defining the rights and obligations between all contracting parties. In this case, the agreement at issue terminated on October 21, 2011, when the parties failed to close the transaction for the property. The rights of the parties in the agreement to mutual performance was thereby extinguished.
Am I right that there's no prevention argument calibrated to the October 21 failure to close?
That is correct, Your Honor. And even if there were, the facts would not support that, because the evidence was that George Wills, who was G&G's managing member.
If there's no argument, there's no reason to worry about it. May I ask you this? The time of the essence provision was expressed in the original contract. Did any of the other later contractual documents take that away?
No, Your Honor.
One of the arguments on that point, it seems to me, is that you can have such a clause and it should be enforced, but it also can be waived. Was there a waiver here?
No, Your Honor. There was no waiver.
Okay.
Would you expand on your answer as to why none of the later contracts took the time of the essence clause away?
Oh, any of the amendments?
Yes. No.
Well, the later amendments, they did change the date of closing, which is typical in these kinds of transactions. But there was never any, by the express terms of the amendments, there it was clear that it was not to amend or to in any way impact the time is of the essence language from the original agreement.
Well, now, let me ask you this. I don't have it in front of me, so I truly am asking you. If this is the fourth amendment, there must have been a second and a third.
Yes, sir, there were.
Was the language of the second and the third amendment either identical or substantially the same with regard to the language except as amended, the agreement is in full force and effect?
That is my understanding. Yes, Your Honor. That's my recollection, that they were same or substantially similar, and it was clear that the time of the essence provision remained.
Wait, I mean, I'm sure you get the point of my question. If you get to the fourth amendment, you're amending the third.
Correct.
If you'd already waived it in the second or the third,
and there was no waiver,
then there'd be no effect of the language in the fourth that you rely on.
But there was no waiver of the.
Counsel, can waiver occur by conduct?
Can waiver occur by conduct?
Yes.
Sure, waiver could.
So if a contract is supposed to terminate by its terms, according to a time is of the essence clause, on July 20th, and on July 21st you wake up and the parties are still treating the contract as if it's alive, and at least for that day, they've waived it, have they not?
If they're treating it as if it's not,
as if neither party has notified the other one, I'm terminating, and instead they're still working towards closing, then at least for that day they have waived the clause by their conduct. They're still moving towards the closing.
They're still moving towards the closing.
Correct. The answer is yes.
Well,
Now, if they continue by their conduct to ignore the time is of the essence clause, and they continue to move towards closing, they have continued on a day-by-day basis to waive that clause, have they not?
I think that's true, but I think the understanding here between as testimony at trial was that the closing attorneys and even General Land's general manager, they understood that once that day had happened that the contract had expired. That was a testimony. Mm-hmm. So theoretically there could be some conduct when parties there's uncertainty between the parties. But here the testimony and the evidence was that the parties, their attorneys, and even the party who brought the suit understood at that time that the October 21 date, when it had passed, that he even testified that there was no commission or there was evidence in that he understood that the that there was no commission payable after that October 21st date.
I understand. I'll tie it together later on. Go ahead.
Well, let me ask you a follow-up to that. If in fact that's correct, and I have no doubt that you can waive the enforcement of the clause by conduct, but if thereafter you enter into an agreement that says, except as amended by this Fourth Amendment, the agreement is in full force and effect, is that a vitiation of the actual waiver by conduct?
Well, I would say...
I hope you're going to say yes.
I would say absolutely. I would say absolutely yes. I think that was the understanding of the parties at all times. They made it very clear that.
Well, no, it's not at all times. That's a point of Justice Mintz's question. The question that he asked is that on the day after, without an agreement, have you waived it by conduct? And the answer, probably, I would think, is yes, you have. But if you thereafter have an amendment of the agreement that says no, we didn't waive it, we're actually reinforcing it by stating it again, except as amended by this Fourth Amendment, the agreement is in full force and effect, which includes time is of the essence. Do you follow that?
Yeah, I see that.
If you blow through a time of the essence date and the contract's over, and you just say, well, why don't we still try to work this out? You're under no contractual obligation to work it out. You can try to if you want to, but you don't have to. Nobody can sue you if you don't.
Exactly.
But if you, as the chief is asking you, you sit down and say, no, let's work this out and let's make a deal. All right, here's the deal. Well, the first agreement still governs. We're going to resurrect that even though time of the essence is flowing through. And we're going to apply it to this amendment. We're just going to give a new date. All right, and as your basic logic follows, the time of the essence follows the new date, and whatever waiver could or couldn't have occurred in the interim has been overtaken by events. But that's the nature of the question you're getting.
Right. Well, I think that what happened here was the parties were unable to close at the time. The understanding was that the contract itself had expired, and they were trying to resurrect a deal and trying to put something together, but they were trying to come up to it with what was in essence a new agreement. It was a new deal. That was the way that it was conceptually and legally. When you read the record, that's the way that it arises, is that they were trying to resurrect the deal. They were trying to put it back together. They were, Humpty Dumpty had fallen off the wall, and they were busily trying to put it back together again. That was the way that it was. That was what was occurring here. And to your question about the prevention doctrine, was it arose as they were trying to put it back together? It had nothing to do with the original agreement and its amendments, but it had to do with the.
Can I call you there with another question on an unrelated point than one we've been talking about? The promise to the broker was to pay the commission if and when the deal closed.
Exactly.
It wasn't a promise to the broker that you would close. That was a promise between the buyer and the seller, a reciprocal promise. We will close. And good faith and fair dealing requires them not to cheat and pretend to close and then not close. But I read your first assignment of error and your third assignment of error together to make the point that, well, the third-party promise was not the same thing as the promise between the bilateral contracting parties, and the third-party promise did not include the promise to close. It just included the promise to pay a commission if it closed. Okay, it didn't close.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. It did not close. It was a conditional. It was a conditional promise made to the broker by the seller that it would a commission would be payable if and only if there was a closing. This is not a situation where there was. It was an unconditional promise. This was not a situation where you had, and this does happen in commercial contracts, where you have clauses that state that a broker will be allowed to recover a commission if there's a default by either party. This is not that kind of situation. There was an express conditional that was quite distinct from the promises.
That's the weird part about your case, is that the prevention doctrine classically is not a third-party beneficiary doctrine anyway. It's simply a doctrine to a breach of a brokerage agreement.
Yes, Your Honor, that's another strange feature of this case.
I'd like to go a little bit deeper into the prevention doctrine with regard to your assignment of error number three.
Yes, Your
Honor. Was there ever a finding by the judge that your client did not want to close, that your client tried to use the term from the doctrine, tried to prevent closing?
There was no finding that they did not want to close. There was what it boiled down to essentially was that that they were unable. That was the judge's language, was that they were unable to close.
And did the judge find that there was that by being unable to close that your client had breached the contract, or that your client was simply unable to fulfill the conditions that would have led to closing?
If my recollection correct is that it would have been the latter, that it would they were not able to fulfill one of the conditions, which would have been a breach, but that of the original agreement, but which we contend was had expired, but it was that they'd failed to be unable to satisfy one of the conditions preceding to the agreement.
Well, failure to satisfy a condition to a contractual duty is not a breach. A breach is you could satisfy a condition and you're choosing not to for some reason. So I wouldn't.
You don't concede that, in other words.
Well, yeah, I don't concede.
You can't concede
that.
A point of law anyway, but.
Right. But I see that. I think the judge, and I think you were talking about how the judge viewed it. My recollection is that I think he viewed that, I believe it was argued as if that were a breach of the agreement, but it did not come down to a condition of that Raztec purposely and intentionally did not satisfy.
When is the notion of breach coextensive with a prevention doctrine anyway? In other words, just because you breached for whatever reason, does it axiomatically follow that the prevention doctrine applies?
I believe it's theoretically. I believe that would be. I think they would have to go hand in hand. That you've actively.
Suppose you're supposed to qualify for financing and you just don't, so the deal falls through. But it's not that you've actively been thwarting this particular condition of the contract. I'm just trying to figure out where the law takes us in this area.
I think the law says that you've acted in excess of your rights and. So you've taken positions, you've taken wrongful positions, and I think it is coextensive with breach. I think it's just a sub part of, you probably could contextualize it as a breach. And it's typically not seen in this kind of, this. It's sort of a strange fit here in this case because it's a third party trying to use the doctrine.
Well, typically prevention is someone is actively trying to thwart the consummation of the contract. Here is someone is working it to the 11th hour to try to get the deal through.
Right, and that's exactly what happened. Was they were trying, they were scrambling. What it boiled down to was that they were unable to get a valid HUD one. There was just a tremendous amount of confusion regarding the attribution of liens, who was responsible for what particular payments, seller versus buyer, but there was a great deal of effort on behalf of all parties to try to get this deal closed. Even after the agreement had expired, they were still trying to craft a new agreement and put something together. But for purposes of this, the agreement upon which the my time has expired.
Justice Blanahan, before you sit down with this expired time, did you have a question pending?
I can ask the other side.
Okay. All right. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
My name is Bill Cave, and I represent the broker General Land Commercial Development Company. Four of the assigned errors in this case are on the grounds that findings of the judge were contrary to the evidence. That's a high bar.
Can I ask you this? The third-party beneficiary claim that you made,
yes.
Your client is not a signatory to the agreement. He's not a party. So he's entering, if at all, into the contractual relationship by implication. So with that predicate point, the promise is I'll pay a commission to you if and only if. I mean, those very words, verbatim.
Right.
It closes. There's no promise to your client that it will close. That promise is between the seller and the buyer and the buyer and the seller. And the good faith and fair dealing caveat to that promise that, yeah, and I won't try to foul up the closing purposely with some pretextual breach, is implicit in that relationship. But I was unable to find a single case, correct me if you found one, where the conditional promise made to a broker in this context has anything at all to do with the prevention doctrine. So am I wrong or right?
Well, in the very first Virginia case on prevention, there was a promise to pay a real estate commission, and the seller held a mortgage on the property, and the commission was to be paid as the sales proceeds were received. And after some few months, the person who bought the property came to the seller and said, I'm not going to be able to do this. I would like Mr. Jones to take my place, and he'll not only pay the same amount, he'll pay it quicker. And when the seller accepted the second buyer, who ultimately defaulted, he put it beyond the ability of the realtor to get his fee. That's a prevention case. That's the one prevention case that I'm sure of where they dealt with the issue of whether a realtor can get his fee. Because what happened in that case was that when the seller put it beyond his ability to collect from the first buyer, he thereby prevented the realtor from collecting his fee as the sales proceeds were received. And the court held you prevented him from getting his fee, and therefore you have to pay it. You can't rely on the condition.
But did that case involve a third-party beneficiary promise that was itself literally an expressive condition upon closing?
It did not.
Well, that's my point.
But the point is this, I think. Whatever the condition is, whether the condition says, as I receive the fee, or whether the condition says, if I close, you can't prevent the condition from occurring. Because once you prevent the condition from occurring, then you've prejudiced the position of the broker. And that puts you under the prevention doctrine. Now, in this case, when we filed
a promise to the broker to close, that logic would be irrefutable. But where is that promise in a third-party beneficiary context like this?
I don't think there is not a directed the seller, in this case, Rastec, said in the contract, I will pay General Land a commission
if
we close. Now, as long as Rastec does nothing to prevent the occurrence of that condition, then Rastec can rely on the condition. But when Rastec is at
what
fault...
What if Rastec say, I just don't want to close?
Well, they can, but that doesn't let them escape their contractual obligations.
How do they have a contractual obligation to your client?
Because my client is named in the agreement as the broker, and the seller says, I'm going to pay the broker a commission if and only if we close.
How is the mere mention of someone conclusive evidence of an intent to establish a third-party beneficiary relationship? I mean, that's all there is, right? There's no other evidence other than we're going to use these folks to close. That's it.
Well, the agreement actually says in two places. It names General Land.
Right.
It specifically says in paragraph 5 that they'll get paid a commission of some certain percentage on the sale of the building parcel and the out parcel.
Right, but just because you're going to use a particular, you know, entity as part of a contract, how does that necessarily show an intent to bestow a benefit on them?
When it says in the contract specifically that Rastec will pay General Land a commission on the sale of this property if it closes, that is bestowing upon General Land a right to that commission if it closes.
So if I'm a car dealer for Toyota and the contract says, you know, I'll use genuine whatever parts, and that's a third party, they can then sue if there's a breach of that contract because they are mentioned in the contract as being a source of, you know, of furnishing parts to the car dealer.
I think if they're ready, willing, and able to provide you with those parts and you decide to stiff them and go somewhere else for your parts, they can.
No, the deal falls apart between Toyota and the dealer, and this third party that was going to provide car parts can sue and say, hey, I was going to sell all these parts, so now you owe me damages. I mean, I'm trying to figure out the boundaries of third-party beneficiary,
okay,
which we've said has to be clearly and definitely intended in the contract. And what I see in this contract is a mention of someone, but beyond that, nothing.
If you look at the statutory provision on how we create a third-party beneficiary, it says that if there is an instrument, and this is a written instrument, and it's for the benefit not only of the parties named, but other parties, that those parties may enforce the agreement just as the original party
could.
Well,
the fact that someone will be benefited by does not necessarily mean it is for the benefit of that party. And maybe that's where I'm struggling. But I don't want to use up all your time.
Counsel, go ahead.
May I ask a question about the prevention doctrine? Let's assume that you cited Parrish, and Parrish does apply the prevention doctrine to a broker or a real estate agent. Witt says that the act that causes the contract not to close has to be wrongful.
Correct.
Help me with the distinction between an inability to satisfy liens or to raise money and wrongful conduct.
The court found that there were three wrongful conducts. The first was that he did not finish the building timely. It was supposed to be finished in October 2010. They extended the contract four times through October of 2011.
Wasn't your client responsible for much of the build out?
No, sir.
Your client had no responsibilities?
No, sir. We had tenant improvements to do, but none of those tenant improvements could be done until after January the 6th of 2012, when the temporary certificate of occupancy was issued.
Okay, go ahead.
That's when our stuff started.
But let's take that one. Did that wrongful conduct prevent them or have any impact on the inability to bring the money to the table at closing, which was the final?
The inability to bring the money to closing came because during the course of construction, Rastec did not pay its subcontractor. Subcontractors worked on the projects. They obtained judgment liens that lodged against the projects. during the last 4 months of this, from October...
Rastec was depending upon a construction loan to pay the subs, was it not?
I think not. I think that they had a construction loan with Union First Market Bank, but they had exhausted most of that construction loan before they got into the heavy construction. What really
Because of poor management of the fund.
Exactly. And what...
But was there... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
If you look at the four amendments, the most important thing that's happening in the four amendments is not just the extension of the construction finish date, but it's that the buyer is extending more money to the construction because Rastec was unable to fund the construction. It went from $300,000 when the contract was signed to $750,000.
And that comes back to my question. How does the inability to fund equate to what WIT would require to be wrongful conduct?
Because the contract says that upon the conveyance of the property, it has to be a free and clear title. There can be no liens on the property.
Yeah, but the question you're being asked is, suppose the seller was unable to fund the deal and was falling down economically on every aspect of the deal. The doctrine requires a showing that the seller did that in order to stop the whole process and not go to closing and not pay the broker and not pay anybody else. Where's the evidence of that? And it doesn't seem to me that the trial court even saw that distinction.
I don't believe that when you sign a contract that says, I'm going to build you a building, and I'm going to give you a building free and clear of liens on the date of closing, that's an essential part of the contract. Nobody's going to buy a building that's got mechanics, liens, and judgment.
I agree with you completely. But the point is, you can breach a buy-sell agreement and not trigger the prevention doctrine. That's my point. And you're telling me that's wrong, that every time you breach it and every time that causes a failure to close, you have triggered the prevention doctrine. Explain to us why your take on that is right.
If the contract had said, I'm going to pay the realtor a commission at closing, period, there was no condition, and the closing didn't occur because I couldn't convey proper title, and I couldn't convey it, it was me, the seller, it's my fault. I can't get the money to build the building, so I build it on the back of the subs, and there's lots of liens filed. So I have breached the contract, not only as to my inability to convey to the buyer, but also as to the obligation from the seller to pay the real estate commission. What brings the prevention doctrine into play is that there is a condition subsequent in the contract that says if and only if it closes. Now, as long as the seller does nothing to prevent that closing, then the prevention doctrine doesn't come into play. But once he prevents the closing, and the judge found he prevented it in three ways.
But, counsel, I think I'm asking the same question, but I think your answer is spinning away from the question.
All right.
The fact of breach, your position has to be based upon equating breach with wrongful conduct.
Correct.
If, in fact, your answer that I interrupted is correct, that would mean every time a seller breaches a contract, no matter how innocently, then the post-closing requirement to pay a commission is going to be triggered. So in other words, as I understand the prevention doctrine, and tell me if I'm wrong, it is there has to be, quote, wrongful conduct, which is a specific intention to prevent the closing that would cause the third-party beneficiary, if indeed it is a third-party beneficiary, to receive a benefit. Where am I wrong in terms of how I interpret the prevention doctrine?
What the prevention doctrine says is that you've done something in excess of your legal rights. It doesn't have to be morally wrongful. It just has to be in excess of your legal rights. Now, in the contract context, if you don't perform under the contract and the third-party beneficiary is injured along with the buyer, then you've done something in excess of your legal rights.
So your position, in fact, is every breach that prevents a closing leads to the requirement to make the post-closing payment to the broker.
If you are the person who is promised to make the payment.
Yeah.
Now, obviously,
every breached contract from now on in Virginia, if your position is accepted, will require a determination to be made about whether the broker goes ahead and gets paid.
Will require a determination to be made as to whether that seller who promised to pay the commission has acted in a way that's in excess of their legal rights.
Has breached. You don't have the right to breach.
Has breached.
So the prevention doctrine now means if you have breached the contract, you have triggered the prevention doctrine analysis.
If you have breached the contract, you cannot rely on a condition as a shield to your liability.
The condition being closing?
Closing. Correct.
Closing is the condition of every real estate contract, is it not?
It isn't. Well, it really isn't. I mean, you can, people can contract and they can get to a closing date and they can simply say, this is not working out, and mutually rescind it. In which case, I think there would be no obligation to anyone. But where, in this case, the judge found that there were three wrongful acts, not finishing the building, not settling with the bank on the short sale agreement, and making yourself unable to bring sufficient funds to closing so that the property could be conveyed.
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Call the next case.